Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. It turns out that the modern discoveries of evolutionary psychology are not so new. Much of it was encapsulated in ancient Buddhist psychology, and these correspondences are now becoming obvious. Both are attempts to understand why we think, feel, and behave the way we do, and the answers they come up with are remarkably congruent. Today we are going to investigate the nature and some remedies for the problems that our brains create for ourselves. Our guest today is Robert Wright, author of the new book, Why Buddhism is True: The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. Robert is the New York Times bestselling author of The Evolution of God, which was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. Non-Zero is another book, and The Moral Animal, Evolutionary Psychology and Everyday Life, Three Scientists and Their Gods, another finalist, this time for the National Books Critics Circle Award. Robert is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the widely respected bloggingheads.tv and has written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times, Time, Slate, and The New Republic. He has taught at the University of Pennsylvania and at Princeton University, where he created the popular online course, Buddhism and Modern Psychology. Hello, Robert, and welcome to the Pathways.
Well, hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Now, the title of your newest book is Why Buddhism is True. Now, according to what criteria can we be judging the truth?
Well, first, I should probably be clear on what part of Buddhism I'm talking about. I'm not talking about what is sometimes called the supernatural part. You know, I'm not talking about reincarnation and so on. I'm talking about what you could call the naturalistic part of Buddhism. In other words, claims that Buddhism makes of a sort that you could evaluate from the standpoint of modern psychology, modern philosophy. More specifically, I'm looking at what you could call the Buddhist diagnosis of the human condition and the Buddhist predicament. And the way I would summarize that is to say that, according to Buddhism, the reason we suffer and the reason we make other people suffer is that we don't see the world clearly. So we have illusions about ourselves, we have illusions about other people, we have illusions about the world. And according to Buddhism, dispelling those illusions can make you suffer less and also can encourage you to behave better toward other people. So it's kind of an amazing claim in a way that you could kill three birds with one stone, you know, by seeing more clearly, you become happier, you become a better person. And so there can be, in principle, this kind of convergence between truth, the truth about the world, and moral truth, and well-being. And I think that's kind of the heart of the claim I'm defending. I'm saying that Buddhism, in sizing up the predicament we're in, why we suffer, what to do about it, is pretty much on target.
And what problem were you perceiving such that you felt this book was needed? Were people saying Buddhism is not true?
That's an interesting question. Well, I mean, I didn't set out to write a book called Why Buddhism is True. It's just that when I finished the book, I realized that the title was defensible, and you know, the publisher liked the title, so I went with it. What I thought was needed was a book that tried to convey to people who consider Buddhism just kind of this ethereal, mystical word that they can't really wrap their minds around, try to convey to them that, you know, if you focus on the kind of philosophical part of Buddhism, it's an analytical kind of school that has ideas about the way the human mind is structured, about human nature, and about why sometimes we feel bad. So it's a set of claims you can analyze just the way you would analyze a Western theory of psychology. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was needed. And another thing I thought is that, or actually I kind of came to think this while writing the book, I guess you could say, but there are a lot of people who meditate. I mean, my own practice is in what you could more or less call mindfulness meditation. I mean, strictly speaking, I've done retreats at Vipassana centers, but it's very closely associated with what we call mindfulness meditation. And mindfulness meditation is, you know, I think thought of by a lot of people as therapy, and it can be effective therapy. You know, it can help you deal with stress, anxiety, remorse, whatever, and that's great, but I think it also can connect you to kind of deeper questions of philosophy, or you might say spirituality. And really some of the most radical claims in all of Buddhism, you know, like the self as you conceive of it does not exist, and that things out there in the world are really not as you are perceiving them. These are deep and radical claims with radical implications for how we behave. And I wanted to convey that even if you're just doing meditation for kind of these therapeutic reasons, you're not that far from using meditation to for deeper kind of philosophical exploration. And I wanted to provide the background information that would help people do that.
Now, these radical claims that you're mentioning are also being borne out by modern psychology, particularly the field known as evolutionary psychology. And one of your previous books touched on or was about evolutionary psychology. How did you become so familiar with evolutionary psychology in the first place? Because my understanding is you're not a psychologist.
No, I'm not a psychologist. I mean, I have taught in a psychology department at Penn, the University of Pennsylvania, but I'm not like a credentialed academic. Some kind of new ideas in evolution, this is now 30, 40 years ago, some new ideas that had emerged in kind of behavioral biology that seemed able to account for certain parts of human nature and the human mind. I was interested in those, and the more I looked into it, the more interested I got, and so I decided to write this book about it. But I emerged from the process of writing the book realizing like a couple of things about human nature. One is, we are not designed to be happy. When I say designed, I should put that in quotes, because natural selection is not a conscious, you know, process, but it does create animals that look as if they were designed. But we're not designed to be happy, and we're not designed to always see the world clearly. So, you know, and in fact, I would say we are, natural selection has ingrained in us certain kinds of illusions about ourselves, and certain kind of distortions, perceptual distortions, because sometimes illusions can help you get genes into the next generation. And according to theory of natural selection, that's the whole game, is whatever traits helped our ancestors get genes into the next generation, those are the traits that constitute the human species. And, you know, it turns out being a little, you might say, deluded can in principle help get genes into the next generation. And then the other thing, as I just mentioned, is that sometimes suffering can help genes get into the next generation. I mean, natural selection did not design us to be enduringly happy. And that's one reason that, like, gratification fades. You know, you see some food, it's enticing, you eat it, you feel good for a while, but then the feeling wears off, you want more food. Same with sex, you know, feels good for a while, then you want more sex. Some promotion you've been gunning for, you get it, feels good for a while, then you'd like another promotion. And when you think about it, natural selection, it was bound to design animals who grow dissatisfied and hunger for more, because that's what keeps them motivated to pursue the goals that get genes into the next generation. And this too corresponds well with Buddhism. Of course, there's a lot of emphasis in Buddhism on the way we fail to really reckon with the impermanence of things, including the impermanence of sensory gratification. And we keep pursuing it, kind of half almost thinking that it's going to last. You know, I mean, at one level we know consciously that these things are not going to last forever. On the other hand, when we're like lusting after something, you know, a donut or whatever, we're just focused on the pleasure, and we're not really thinking about how ephemeral it's going to be. So that's a big emphasis in Buddhism, or failure to reckon with impermanence. So that's another thing that kind of corresponds to evolutionary psychology. So all of these things, you know, we are prone to suffering, we don't always see the world clearly, we don't reckon with impermanence. All of these things, which are part of Buddhism, I think are well explained by evolutionary psychology, and that's why after writing the book on evolutionary psychology, it's one reason that I got interested in Buddhism.
Now, Buddhism goes a step further than evolutionary psychology in terms of recommending a remedy for this kind of suffering. In other words, they both seem to agree on the facts of the matter,
right.
But Buddhism goes a step further in terms of dealing with the problem of suffering, if you want to consider it a problem. And of course, it is a problem for anybody who wants to be happy,
right.
And impermanence, etc. So that's been your experience, right, as a meditator, that it actually has helped you? Is it kind of an antidote to this terrible predicament we are, where nature has designed us without any regard to whether we're happy or not?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're right. Evolutionary psychology has a diagnosis, in a way, that corresponds to Buddhism's diagnosis of the human predicament, but evolutionary psychology doesn't have a prescription. It doesn't tell you what to do about it. Mm-hmm. Whereas Buddhism does, and part of that prescription, an important part, is meditation. And yeah, I think meditation can help, as advertised. For starters, it can help you deal with troublesome feelings like anxiety and stress and so on. And a lot of these feelings, I mean, they're interesting to look at from the standpoint of evolutionary psychology, because you realize two things. First of all, some of these feelings are natural. They're designed into us, apparently, like anxiety. It's natural to worry about your children. It's natural to worry about how you are viewed by other people. But then the modern environment takes these natural feelings and makes them even more problematic than they might otherwise be. So, you know, you have situations where you might drop a toddler off at a daycare center on the first day where you don't know anyone and then leave them there all day. That's not a natural, you know, during evolution, like when we were in more or less a hunter-gatherer environment, nobody ever left their kids with a bunch of people they didn't know, right? So that causes a new kind of anxiety. Or like public speaking, talking to a bunch of people you've never met. That didn't happen. And so that's going to cause a new kind of anxiety. So there are all these new sources of often really unproductive anxiety in the modern world. And I think that understanding the backstory of these feelings that you're dealing with through meditation can help, because it reinforces that why you should treat them skeptically, which is part of the idea of mindfulness meditation, is to go into all your feelings skeptically, right? You just kind of take a look at them, and you shouldn't assume that they are reliable guides, and you might choose not to be guided by them. You know, I just look, you know, experience a feeling, examine it, and decide not to get on board, especially with unpleasant, unproductive feelings like anxiety. So I hope that the backstory I'm providing from evolutionary psychology is of some value to meditators.
I think it's interesting to consider that evolution as a designer is not necessarily the most intelligent designer.
No.
It's sort of like constantly patching the system, because
right.
That's all it can do.
Right, incrementally.
You know, like I was in the software business, and there comes a point, you know, after 4 or 5 years and the things become unstable and you've added features
over, right?
And you have all these, but yeah, you just start over and do it right. You know what you need, you know what the problems are, but evolution can't do that.
No, that's
so
right.
So we've got this old brain. We were around for a million years before, right. As hunter-gatherers,
right.
We're having a panic attack really served us,
right.
As a survival mechanism.
Right.
And now it's a problem.
No, that's right. I mean, there's all kinds of problems. It's like, why do people have bad backs? We were not designed to sit in chairs all day. You know, and you're right. Natural selection, it doesn't work very fast. So it can't take account of the modern environment. And that's why we have invented things to make the adaptation to the modern environment, and the things range from drug therapies to meditation. I mean, that's like an invention that helps us deal with not only feelings that have become maladaptive in the modern environment, because some feelings were problematic even in the ancestral environment, but certainly some of them become more problematic, like rage. I mean, road rage. It's when you look at what rage was originally designed for, it just seems totally crazy to unleash it on the road, because the original idea apparently was that if someone had like offended you or they stole something or stole your mate, you had to like make a show of retaliation, because you had to establish in front of the people that you lived with every day that you are not to be trifled with. So you're enraged, you're indignant, you may start a fight, and you may even get hurt in the fight, but at least you've shown that you can't you can't be trifled with. Well, now in the modern environment, you look at the way rage plays out, it usually doesn't even make that kind of sense, whatever value there was to that logic, because in a road rage incident, you're not going to see any of the witnesses again. There's no point in showing off in front of them. And so there's a lot of feelings like this, and meditation is good for dealing with feelings generally.
So I suppose if you understand that your anxiety is overblown, or that your depression or even your hatred is dysfunctional in the current context, that helps you accept the fact that, hey, this is your tricky brain acting up.
Yeah.
And then you can accept that that's what's happening and not be swayed by it as much?
Yeah, I think that helps. I mean, of course, meditation on its own is a powerful tool for you might say, viewing feelings more objectively and managing to loosen your attachment to them, or their attachment to you, their grip on you. So meditation can do that even if you don't have the backstory as to how feelings originated and what they're for. But I think it helps to understand how we wound up in this situation, and to think about natural selection as this, it is our creator, but that doesn't mean we have to revere it. I mean, it to begin with had this kind of strange agenda of like getting genes into the next generation, which, when you think about it, shouldn't necessarily govern anyone's life. I mean, it's great that this process, operating by this kind of strange criterion, created these intelligent beings, and I want to emphasize, it gave us a lot of resources to work with. I mean, love is natural, compassion is natural. At the same time, it kind of warped the deployment of them. So we don't deploy compassion and love equally. We favor relatives and so on, and if we have rivals, we tend to have the opposite, feel the opposite of love and compassion toward them, and our view of them and their behavior gets kind of distorted and so on. So natural selection gave us resources to work with, including just a reflective intelligence with which to think about all this. That's all great, but we are not naturally inclined to deploy our resources in ways that bring happiness to us or that necessarily make us good people. And I think that's where Buddhism comes in.
I think it's great in your book about how you describe the way that meditation can help us develop a different relationship to our feelings and to our thinking and to our sense of self, to mm-hmm. our identity, to the answer the question, who am I? That's really what meditation is doing, right? It's giving us a chance to develop, not to suppress things, but to develop a different relationship to them.
I think that's right, and it's a subtle distinction. I mean, people sometimes think like, so the idea of Buddhist meditation is to totally neutralize all your feelings. It's not like that. Now, it does help you loosen the grip of problematic feelings, and in that sense, maybe they are in some sense subdued, but it's not like a deadener. It changes your relationship to feelings. Sadness still happens, but it doesn't control you. And it's a subtle thing for people who haven't meditated to appreciate.
I think one of the things about meditation that I've heard so many times is people say, I can't meditate. I just can't do it. I can't stop thinking. And I've said to them, well, it's not about stopping thoughts from arising. It's about stopping investing in them or identifying with them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's the same with feelings. And it's recognizing that you have the option of identifying with the contents of your mind or not. And that's why when I said, meditation actually has, mindfulness meditation, however therapeutic it may sound, has a connection to deep ideas such as not self, This is one thing I have in mind. You know, people may have heard of like really adept meditators having the full-on not self experience and having trouble like conveying what that means. But I would say that when you selectively cease to identify so strongly with certain contents of your mind, even for just therapeutic reasons, I think you're kind of making a step in the direction of not self. And in fact, if you talk to meditators who have had the full-on version of this, which can include a sense that the bounds of the self have dissolved, and it's like a continuity between you and other beings with all the kind of benign moral implications that has, they often will describe a path that starts with examining feelings, thoughts, loosening your identification with them. So that can be a step toward deeper experience.
We tend to think that we should have this unified self, what you call the CEO self, this decision maker, and you describe that as a delusion.
Yeah, and you know, Buddhism for some time has been saying that this notion, for millennia, has been saying that this notion of this of the conscious self as this CEO that's in charge of things is really not right. And I would say psychology over the last 40 years or so has been amassing more and more evidence that indeed the CEO metaphor is not apt, that the conscious mind is less in control than it thinks it is. That, you know, we think of ourselves as like the generator of the thoughts, the maker of the decisions. But there's more and more evidence that thoughts are kind of like injected into consciousness, and then we habitually and maybe naturally and instinctively choose to identify with them and think of ourselves as the owners of them. But the conscious self is not really the originator of them, and it's often seems to be not the decider, not the decision maker that decides what you say or what you do next. But it convinces itself that it is. And I think that's part of, not all of, but it's part of what Buddhism means by the illusion of self.
I thought it was very helpful how you helped the reader understand this concept of the not self. And you write in the book, the self doesn't exist in an ultimate sense, but it exists in a conventional sense.
Right.
And that's so interesting, because how can we even talk without some sense of duality, without some sense of who we are?
Yeah, and that's kind of the standard Buddhist answer to people who say, wait, what do you mean? I mean, obviously I'm here and I'm going to go to my appointments tomorrow and entertain guests tomorrow and so on. And the standard answer is say, well, yes, that's speaking in conventional language, but at some ultimate level, you, let's just say, are not nearly what you think you are. And that means different things. It means, in part, that the conscious self is not the CEO, but kind of relatedly, it means you are much more under the influence of causes impinging on you than you realize. I mean, the system that you think of as you is a more fluid, permeable system, and you're being influenced by things all the time, and you're, you know, not all the action is originating with you. And one thing about mindfulness meditation is it helps you be aware of the influence, the pathways of influence, aware of how things in your environment are triggering feelings, and awareness of that makes it easier to decide whether to follow the feelings, and so to regain some control from an environment that's pushing and pulling you. Now, I know it sounds ironic to say you regain control. Didn't we say that you don't exist? Well, this is part of the inherent paradox, and it's, as you said, often addressed by distinguishing between the conventional and the ultimate. I think, certainly for beginning meditators, the main thing is it works. It does in effect give you control.
It is highly ironic that the primary technology, if you will, of meditation is letting go, rather than identification.
And yet that letting go can be empowering.
Right. And somebody's doing it, or it seems like somebody's doing
it.
You know, there's somebody choosing to let go.
Right.
I like this quote in the book. A meditation teacher in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition has said, quote, ultimately happiness comes down to choosing between the discomfort of becoming aware of your mental afflictions and the discomfort of being ruled by them.
Right. And, you know, I was talking about my state of mind after I wrote the book on evolutionary psychology. And I found that I had the worst of both worlds. I was aware of them and I was being ruled by them. Now, meditation offers you a way to, by becoming acutely aware of them, cease to be ruled by them. And that's what I didn't have coming out of evolutionary psychology.
Right. You write about how natural selection will, quote, readily delude us about what does and doesn't bring lasting happiness if that delusion has propelled our ancestors' genes forward.
Right.
And it's so interesting how these delusions actually have accomplished that aim to some extent, this pursuit of pleasure,
right.
This relentless pursuit of pleasure, even when you rationally can know that there's a hangover effect,
right,
or dissatisfaction right around the corner.
Right.
That's just amazing.
No, and that's why I think that dissatisfaction is so emphasized in Buddhism. You know, the word dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, a lot of scholars say could also be translated as like unsatisfactoriness, dissatisfaction. And you're right, we're designed for that state to keep surfacing, and we are also designed not to really anticipate it unless we really work at it. The funny thing is that when you start letting go of the headlong pursuit of sensory gratification, and I don't claim to be, you know, an expert at it, but you get especially good at it, like on meditation retreats and so on. And the irony is that letting go of the pursuit of pleasure doesn't mean the end of pleasure. It's a much less grasping state is a very pleasant state to be in, and in my experience, it deepens your appreciation of beauty and your aesthetic sensitivity.
Well, you explain that and so much more in the book in a really beautiful way, and I really enjoyed reading it. I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you, Paul.
I wish we had a lot more time, and I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is mindfulresistance.net. All one word, mindfulresistance.net. And for those who tuned in late, this is your Pathways host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview anytime you want, via the internet or as a free podcast. Today we have been visiting with Robert Wright, author of Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into the Pathways program, which is broadcast and streamed worldwide via KBOO.fm Sunday mornings at 8:30 a.m. USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. Just search for Paul O'Brien or Pathways. And this is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcast. And thanks again to Robert Wright and to all of your listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways experience.